Shalom. Hello again. Well, here's the second in our series of three programs we've made on the Dead Sea Scrolls to follow the national special we had in May that played coast to coast in prime time. As the news breaks, we'll make more programs. We want to do the opposite of what the scholars who suppressed the scrolls for these 40 years did. We want to give you the news immediately. On tonight's program, we'll have our two key experts on the subject, Professor James Tabor, and he's going to talk to us about the way they search the caves. It's very interesting, the equipment they use today and so on, and a little of the philosophy of what he feels as he finds these magnificent 2,000-year-old writings. And we'll have Professor Robert Eisenman, who is instrumental in the release of the new translations. In other words, this new translation made from the Concordance and so on. He was very helpful in getting these scrolls released to a hungry Christian world. And he also will describe the history and kind of the suppression of the scrolls over the period of time. Very, very interesting story I'd like you to hear. Our man on location, Bill Dackman, as usual, will talk to these scholars, and I'll return after this.
What happened was back in 1985, 86, I was the National Endowment for the Humanities, American Schools of Oriental Research, professor in residence at the Albright School in Jerusalem, the famous American school. And I came here to do research on the parallels between the early Christian community in Jerusalem and the Qumran community. But I was not able to do any research because they had all the scrolls sequestered, and there was nothing new we could do in Jerusalem that we couldn't do back in California. So when we saw what that situation was and that we basically wasted a whole year, we began to get very anxious about the access situation to the scrolls, and we started this campaign. And in 1989, we officially wrote to Strugnell and then to who was then the new editor of the Scrolls International Committee, John Strugnell, and to Drori, Amir Drori, who was the new director of the Department of Antiquities in Israel. We officially asked for access to hitherto sequestered scrolls, and we found that they were not going to give us access. Our intention at that time was to do a court case in the Supreme Court. The import of that desire to do that had been to push them forward to open up the situation more. At that time, I began to receive pictures. People began, from sources, seeing my position on the point of the struggle to free up access to the scrolls. Pictures began to come to me from unidentified sources that I'm not at liberty to tell. And I suppose the reason I was singled out was because they figured I'd know what to do with them. And they were right. I did know what to do with them. And my intent from the beginning was to publish all the scrolls, have free access for everybody. I never liked this idea that only qualified scholars, because the moment you get into the idea of qualified, then they say, well, who's qualified? He's qualified and he isn't. Professor Golb in Chicago, who's a great scholar in his own right because he disagrees with this professor over here, they can say he isn't qualified. Or a fundamentalist Christian, or someone who believes in the word of the Bible or something like that, because they don't like his theories about what he thinks about the Bible, then they say that he's a fanatic or a crazy. We're not going to give him access. That's not the way scientific endeavor moves forward. Scientific endeavor moves forward by free information. We began to see that the whole thing was kind of peculiar, and we began to look into the origins of what happened. And that goes back into the whole history of how the scrolls were found, who found them, and the process of finding. And your audience or your listeners or viewers may not know, the first scrolls were found in the middle of the Arab-Israeli struggle in 1947. And those scrolls, one way or another, found their way into the hands of the Israelis. And most people thought that was all the scrolls there were. That was considered or called Cave 1. As the caves were revealed, they got numbers in the order, chronological order, in which they were found. So the scrolls from Cave 1 made their way ultimately into an institution in Israel known as the Museum of the Book. So when they got into that, and at that time the Israelis did not try to make any political capital out of them. They didn't try to build scholarly empires. They published everything. They didn't publish final editions with commentaries that let everyone have free access, and that was the right way to proceed. However, after that began to happen, more scrolls came in. At that time, the partition of Palestine occurred. Those were caves 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, et cetera, on up to 14. So between 1949 and 1956, a whole new other group of scrolls were coming in. But by that time, the area was under Jordanian administration. These were Hebrew, Aramaic documents. Before the rise of Islam, the Jordanians were not particularly interested in them. So who in East Jerusalem was Johnny on the spot to take over the situation? As it turned out, there was a churchman. His name was Roland DeVoe. He was the head of the Dominican order in Palestine. He wore two hats. He also was head of a school of French Vatican archaeology known as the École Biblique. He was the one the Jordanians, or he turned to the Jordanians, or vice versa. In any case, between the two of them, Father DeVoe basically took the documents off the Jordanians' hands. And in this process, he developed what he called an international committee. It was only international in name only, because first of all, it was always Judenrein. That is, no Jew could ever be part of this committee. So it was a fiction of an international committee, but on the whole, it was dominated by churchmen. For the few non-church or Protestant scholars that were part of this committee, there was always more cleric-type monastic individuals who were part of this committee. That is, the principal people were Father DeVoe himself, a man called Father Millick, another man called Father Starkey, and in the present generation, they have been succeeded by a father called Emil Puech. He is the reigning Dominican father at the present time. What we discovered, that there was a kind of fiction developed here. That is, there were two kinds of scrolls that were coming in, and this is very difficult for your viewers maybe to understand. One were biblical texts, texts of the Bible, old texts that showed that the Bible as we had it was basically the same text that was operating then. But there was another group of texts that were actually even more interesting. People would have thought the biblical texts were the most interesting. In fact, they weren't. They were new texts no one ever saw before, what we called sectarian texts or non-biblical texts. These texts always seems to go to these clerics. That is, the Protestant members of the committee, on the whole, were given the biblical texts. They were represented primarily by a man, Frank Cross, at Harvard. But the other texts basically went into the hands of Millick and this individual that we now know, Strugnell, and some others of that kind, Father Starkey. And basically they were getting the most interesting text because they were interested to see from this period what was happening. So what developed was an information management policy. Like any institution, information is always managed in one way or the other. And their basic desire was to play down, reduce the interest in the scrolls, and to make it look like we had documents that were not of the most incredible importance for the history of early Christianity in Palestine. So what happened between the early 60s and the present was that basically all the Protestant members were pushed off of the committee. Allegra was pushed off of the committee. A man called Hunziker in Germany was pushed off of the committee. The individual from England that we referred to, John Strugnell, converted to Catholicism. And basically you had a committee dominated by churchmen and clerics. And that was the situation up to the mid-80s when we began, as I said, to see this weird situation where we had utter secrecy and no one was allowed to see anything. And when we began to agitate, the strange thing was that we ran up against the Israeli authorities. Now you might say, how come the Israeli authorities got into it? Well, a very peculiar thing happened. In 1965, John Allegra, who had been fired from the committee by the others, because he was English, had great influence with the Jordanian authorities. And at that time, the Jordanians themselves were getting very fed up with what they were witnessing as far as the secrecy of this committee. John Allegro prevailed upon the king and his associates to nationalize the material in the East Jerusalem area in the Rockefeller Museum. And so in 1966, right before the Six-Day War, the Jordanian government nationalized the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Rockefeller Museum as a preliminary step towards taking control away from this church-dominated group and giving it to a more open scholarly group. The Israelis conquered the area in 1967. They benefited from John Allegro's pressure on the Jordanian government. That is, the Israelis now succeeded to the ownership of the scrolls because the Jordanians had nationalized them. But the Israelis knew nothing about all of this conflict that had gone on before. And so they basically gave the International Committee a new lease on life. So we have 20 more years of secrecy now under Israeli sponsorship. when the Israelis began to realize what was going on in 1986, 87, and 88, and under our pressure began to introduce their own people, then they became sensitive because they said to the world at large, look, we've just got our people into this now. How come you're just taking it away from us? And that was the basic approach of the Israeli establishment of the newspapers in Israel and so on. But our response to that was simple. It was too little, too late. The time had come for open access to all scholars without differentiation, and we achieved that this year through three events. One, the computerized reconstruction of the unpublished transcripts. Two, the opening of the Huntington Library files, for which I was a consultant, and I was the first scholar to be allowed in to see the Huntington Library files. And three, our final publication of the complete facsimile edition of all of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which we did in November, which included all the pictures that had been coming to us since 1989, approximately 1,800 plates. As far as we're concerned, the whole controversy is over.
Now that the latest scrolls have been released, where does the search for new material go from here? We'll explore that question with Professor James Tabor.
We just want to solve the mystery. Who are these people? Are there more scrolls? So there are really two phases: systematically surveying all the caves and doing the ground scan in the more interesting areas.
Can you tell us about what you're doing here today?
Our purpose is twofold. First, we have permission. You have to get permission to do anything over here. We have permission from the Israelis, from the Department of Antiquities, to survey, to do a cave survey from Jericho north of here all the way down to En Gedi. And we're right in the area where all the materials have been found. Not only have materials been found right here behind us, but also on down towards En Gedi, and other wadis have been found materials. It's a very rich area. From 100 years before the time of Jesus to about 150 years after, Jewish religious refugees, let's call them, were coming out into this desert, living, hiding, working. They've left stuff. They've left scrolls. They've left their remains. So the biggest thing we're doing is every day our teams go out in the morning. We're divided into teams. They've been given a kilometer down the highway, and they map every single cave. And as you can see, driving up the road, we're speaking about thousands of caves. We have very detailed maps like this, which take each kilometer block. And we've taken each kilometer. Like, my kilometer is 253 south. I've been working on it for a week now. That means we go up in all the cliffs. You have to go up. What you do is you first map them from the ground, as you can see them, then you start going up. What often happens, though, is you get up there and you'll see something that you couldn't see from the ground. Like, the area I happen to be in has five plateaus. We discovered various caves and things that you cannot see until you get to the next level. The other thing that happens is you'll see a narrow slit, maybe a meter high, and you think, well, that's just what we call an animal hole, or, you know, maybe a mountain lion hangs out there. But you get up to it and look in, and it's a narrow opening into a whole cave, you see. Now, those are the type you miss, but actually that the zealots and the messianic believers and so on would have wanted to find most, because that's exactly what the Romans would think. Like, well, there's nothing there. Like the scrolls found in Cave 1, you know, I mentioned earlier, small opening, you couldn't see. We will then begin systematic exploration. This will go over several years, of all the caves that look promising. This is a very lengthy thing. See, what has happened is when the scrolls were discovered by the Bedouins, the Europeans got involved, Father DeVoe and the Catholic team especially. But it was mainly treasure hunting, like scurry up these caves, look in them all quickly, let's hope we find something, then we can sell it to the Europeans for so much per centimeter. This is what it finally came down to. They brought it like in shoe boxes full. You know, here I found these. Where did you find those? Oh, in a cave over there. Sometimes we're not even sure where this material came from, you see. So we think there are still materials here, and we want to find them. And we think they relate to the wilderness communities that were out here during all of these periods. And I would think perhaps there are materials from the Jesus movement. Now, that would be a find. Nothing outside the New Testament has ever been found from the first century. But the striking thing about what we're doing, this is, I'm still talking about the first part of what we're doing, surveying, is it's never been done systematically. See?
Are you using something special to help you find things?
No, when you go up in the cliffs, we are using radar ground scan equipment. If we find, let's say you go in a cave and it looks really promising, Roman pottery, fire marks on the wall, clearly inhabited from the period, and you have 3 to 4 meters of bat dung and debris. We are modern archaeologists. What do? We don't just take our team in with masks and start digging and sweating. We take the ground scan in, run it around the floor of the cave. It tells us how deep everything is. This is the new lazy man's way to do archaeology.
This is Geophysical Survey Systems Subsurface Interface Radar System number 10. The unit is the acquisition system, which is capable of connecting to the 500 megahertz antenna that you see in front of me. These pieces of equipment together can identify with changes that occur below the surface, and the hopes are that we may be able to identify with voids or cavities or changes in the earth that may present indications or evidence of where we might have antiquities or some other type of interesting artifacts that have been left here over the centuries. Mr. Thomas Fenner, one of our geologists, has used the equipment in Egypt in front of the Great Pyramids, where he's discovered a channel that has led to the location of some antiquities. It's been used in Greenland to locate a number of jet bombers that were lost after the war there and have been etched into the ice.
With the ground scan, you don't have to excavate, which creates great problems anyway with the Orthodox Jewish community about digging up a Jewish grave for scientific reasons. It's just not to be done. Now, when you ground scan a tomb, you don't get a lot, but and there aren't many artifacts in tombs, but you could at least verify where all the tombs are and so on. Now, we won't have time to do that this trip, but it gives you an idea of the possibilities that... It's not the answer to everything, but it's certainly a time saver. And also, you don't go tearing up the landscape. Like right where we are now, if they lived right behind us here, and you walk right here and you see this pathway here, what was right here in front of me 20, 30 meters? It hasn't been dug. We can come along the ground scan. We might find that there were structures right here where we're standing. The land is so rich that... it's going to take a few centuries to get around to everything, but we have to choose priorities. And for those of us interested in the roots of Western civilization, which takes us to Christianity, which takes us to Jesus, which takes us to this desert, which takes us to this spot where we're sitting, I would rather dig here than anywhere else. So that's why I'm here.
If you had only one wish, just one wish, in something to find, what would it be?
A letter written by James. And in that letter could be many interesting things, but perhaps just some even common things. Just because he was the leader of the group from the year 30 to 62, that's 30 years. He had an old and long career, and he bridged the generation, and he was revered by the Jews who didn't accept Jesus as well as the Jews who did. And anything from him would be, in a way, it would probably be the most incredible archaeological find of the century, only because, there are many Christians who don't even think Jesus had a brother, right? So here we have a letter from him. That would sort of nail it down a bit. But also, what would he say about his own brother? It would be very interesting to get... and he led the community. I said earlier, Peter didn't lead. Peter led, but Peter was more the missionary going out, you see. But the home front, you know, the man who... If you read in the book of Acts, he gets up in front of the whole Messianic assembly and says, my decision is that we do this. And everybody you know, this is Jesus' brother. This man has been given a great position. So, yeah, that's my fantasy. Find a letter from James and let it say what it says, but I hope it would say some fascinating things.
Well, Professor Tabor's speculation's fascinating. What would James, the brother of Jesus, write in a letter to his older brother? James is becoming a hero of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's clear that he was officiating at Qumran, and many feel he's the author of a Jamesian kind of early Christianity. When we look at the epistle, of course, he wrote the epistle of James, and the introduction in my Scofield Bible says something about him. James, called the Just, mentioned by Paul with Cephas and John as pillars in the church at Jerusalem. He seems to have been, as a religious man, austere, legal, ceremonial. He was a very a serious believer, let's put it that way. If he were a Jew today, we would say very orthodox. His book is addressed to the 12 tribes of Israel, that is, the dispersed Jewish believers throughout the empire. So we have epistles to the Jews, James, Peter, Hebrews, John, and so on. And they say about him, he was always in prayer. There were calluses on his knees, imagine. His epistle seems to discuss what he calls the perfect law of liberty. We could quote James 1:25, but whoso looketh into the perfect law of liberty and continueth therein, he being not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed indeed. And the things about the works, doers of works and not just hearers and so on. Without works, faith is dead, James said, not meaning that we believe by works, but when we believe by faith, then our faith transmits into works for this Christianity, for this Messianic Judaism. He wrote, ye have not, for ye ask not, and pleaded with people to be constantly in prayer. And he himself did that. He wrote, honor the poor, and his brother taught the same and always did that. Would James say to Jesus Christ, you're too liberal. Only Gentiles are going to follow you with the kind of message you have. At Qumran, people were almost monastic. They lived a very austere lives, like it says of James here. They were not people, you might say. Jesus enjoyed a good meal. Jesus ate with publicans and sinners. He was criticized for that. The Lord had an ironic style of speaking. He wasn't afraid to address a crowd. The people down at Qumran, that would not be true of those. John the Baptist was kind of a transitional figure. He could live at Qumran in the wilderness. He could eat locusts and honey, but he was a people person. He would go to the Jordan and baptize crowds. He would lecture them. He would preach to them. He would cry out, a voice crying in the wilderness, and he would be able to reckon with a crowd of people. James and Jesus were different, brothers who observed Judaism in different ways. Of course, I'm talking about Jesus as a man. We're talking, too, of the Son of God, we remember. I don't know. My overall impression is, looking at all that Jesus said, perhaps looking at writings about him, perhaps hearing from people who knew Jesus and heard him speak, James really would have written, as it was written of Jesus in the gospel, truly, thou art the Son of God.